specialty food. It's an $80 billion industry that seems to offer some opportunities for people who are looking to start small food businesses. This is because many consumers these days are bypassing big-name brands for more artisanal and locally made foods. But as NPR's Allison Arbery reports, those who jump into this industry find obstacles they might not have expected.
A few years back when the economy was in the tank, Jonas Singer was unemployed and looking for something new to try. He was interested in food, and so was his friend Cullen Gilchrist. So the two of them decided to open a cafe.
We had a friend called Darnell, who owns Darnell's, which is a bar in Northwest D.C. And Jonas, my business partner, just went up to him and asked if we could open a cafe there during the mornings.
Now, between Jonah's business chops and Cullen's years of working in restaurants, they thought they were good to go. So when they hung their sign for the Blind Dog Cafe, they started working out of a 2-foot kitchen in the back of the bar using an old KitchenAid mixer.
I had this dream of making everything from scratch.
Which they did. But along the way, they learned a lot about what it really takes to run a food business. You need licenses, health inspections. And to make money, they quickly realized they needed to scale up and move to a professional kitchen.
So we started looking around, and there's nowhere. There's no shared kitchens. We could only find things that were absolutely enormous.
And way out of their budget, leases ran in the tens of thousands of dollars. Cullen and Jonas were not alone. The local food scene was starting to take off. There were kombucha makers, local creameries, all the food trucks. But there was no infrastructure to support these startups.
We were at the cafe all day, and people would come and be like, I make pickles for a living. We'd be like, that's awesome. Where do you do it? Church basement, you know? Everyone had a bad answer to that question.
So Cullen and Jonas took an idea from the tech sector. Technology incubators are places where tech startups share space and try to grow their businesses. Why not start a food incubator?
Welcome to Union Kitchen.
It's 7 a.m. at this converted brick warehouse, not far from the U.S. Capitol, and the place is already buzzing. Among the 50 startups, there are bakers, beverage makers, even Korean taco makers.
So this is the main kitchen area.
It feels kind of like a cross between a busy restaurant kitchen and a group house where everybody's cooking on top of each other and using each other's stuff. At one station, a 60-quart mixer hums against a stainless steel counter as baker Jenna Huntsberger pulls sheets of cookies out of double-stacked convection ovens.
This is a brown butter snickerdoodle, and then this is a salty oatmeal cookie.
Jenna is back-to-back with two guys sautéing tofu, part of an Asian food startup, and a sausage maker who's hand-rolling half-smokes. And what's that behind the sausages?
These are all 50-gallon drums, all filled with kombucha.
That's Daniel Bay. He's kind of like the roommate who leaves his food sitting around a little too long, but he's following a precise method, fermenting teas into kombucha. Lots of it.
So we have like a peach tea, we have a coconut tea, all different kinds.
Both Daniel Bay and Jenna Huntsberger say moving into the incubator has given their businesses a boost.
My business has grown over 100% from what we did in 2012 to what we're going to do in 2014.
So here's how the incubator works. Jenna has a membership, kind of like a gym membership. Her monthly fees cover the use of the mixer, the ovens, all the equipment. It's about a fifth of the cost of leasing her own space. But Union Kitchen is a lot more than just a shared space. Soon after Cullen Gilchrist started the incubator, he realized that most of the startups had a lot to learn.
You know, it's like, wow, this person has no idea they need a business license. This person's never had a health inspection. So we saw all those things. We started making solutions for each step along the way.
So now members can pay extra for help with sales, marketing, and perhaps more importantly, a way to distribute their food.
We do distribution now, where Whole Foods can just call us.
Grocers and other wholesalers can order food from any of the 50 businesses.
We drive it out there, we drop it off, put it on the shelves. Whole Foods, whoever, just pays us. And then we take the money and we pay it out to everyone. So we take all the hassle out.
It's working all over the country. There are now more than 100 food incubators, and not just in foodie meccas like Portland and San Francisco, but also North Carolina, Ohio, and Louisiana. At Union Kitchen, 10 members and alumni businesses are moving up and out to open their own storefronts this year, which is about 20% of the startups.
A lot of people are growing, and they're growing rapidly, which is awesome.
But in a business as tough as food, of course, there's no guarantee of success. So what if, after testing the waters, some of these rookies realize it's just not for them?
I mean, you want to open a business here, and 3 months in you realize it was a terrible idea, you're out a couple $1,000s.
You haven't taken out a big loan or signed a lease, so you cut your losses and you move on. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
If you're at the beach this summer, I'm not sure if this is good news or bad news. Many of the fish swimming around you are alien invaders that threaten the environment and the economy. Of the schemes to get rid of them, one in particular has caught the attention of Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf.
If you can't beat them, eat them. Add kitchen knives to the list of weapons that we humans are using to fight invasive species. I'm talking about fish who have made their way into non-native waters. How do they get here? Sometimes they catch a ride in the ballast water of ships, or they're imported as live food or dumped out of aquariums. Once here, they can wipe out native fish, trash the ecosystem, and wreck the beach business. Take the Asian snakehead, which has made its way into tributaries of the Chesapeake Bay. It competes with native species for food and then eats the native species. This fish has a mouthful of sharp teeth. It's been called Fishzilla. The snakehead hangs out in grassy shallows, making it best caught with a bow and arrow. But a couple of years ago, Maryland State started promoting snakehead as an eating fish. Its harvest has increased from 0 to 5,000 pounds a year. Blue catfish is another alien invader. In its native Mississippi River Basin, the blue catfish is a healthy part of the ecosystem. But it was planted in northeastern waters as sport fish, and now it's become a ferocious predator. So now, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources has started promoting this fish as good eating, too. It's not a bottom feeder like other catfish, so it has a clean flavor. Excellent for fish and chips. Asian carp got into the Mississippi River and has been making its unwelcome way north. A chef in Louisiana renamed it Silverfin and now serves it almondine. There are some critics of this tactic of eating invasive species, those who worry that it will create demand. Steve Vilnet, director of fisheries marketing for the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, says, "If we sell the last blue catfish, we've done our job." In the meantime, though, his slogan for the fish is, "Malicious but delicious."
Bonnie Wolf is managing editor of AmericanFoodRoots.com.
The American economy is in recovery, but still more than 46 million Americans, that's one in seven people, used a food pantry last year. And a surprisingly high number of these people were from military families. That's according to a new study by Feeding America, which is a network of U.S. food banks. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Volunteers at the Maryland Food Bank in Baltimore sort through boxes and cans of food as they pass by on a conveyor belt to be packed for distribution.
I'd send it down maybe to dessert.
Sweets are put in one box, canned vegetables go in another, cereal goes in another. This food bank, like others across the country, is facing a growing demand for food. And CEO Deborah Flateman says last year they started dealing with some new clients.
We've been at Fort Meade, we've been at Fort Detrick, the Aberdeen Proving Grounds.
Those are local military bases. The food bank hasn't necessarily been at the bases, but nearby, with its mobile food pantry, which distributed more than 200,000 pounds of food over the past year to military families.
They're not unlike any of the other families that we serve. You know, they meet hardship and they need assistance with food. I'm thrilled that the Maryland Food Bank is the place that they come to get that assistance.
And other food banks and pantries say they're also seeing an increase.
Absolutely. We're less than a mile from Dover Air Force Base here in Dover.
Margaret Young is with the Calvary Assembly of God Church in Dover, Delaware, where she oversees a food pantry. Young noticed about 4 years ago that more military families were showing up for help. She says they're usually young, junior-level service members with kids.
And then, of course, they have younger spouses. And their spouses, you know, when you have to relocate every couple of months or a couple of years, however that works, it makes it harder for them to find jobs. So that I think that's the primary reason.
Because on one salary, it's hard for many families to make ends meet. Maura Daly of Feeding America says that's what they found in a recent survey of food bank clients, military and non-military alike, that even though most of their clients work, they face difficult financial decisions.
Between things like food and paying for their utilities, food and paying for transportation, food and paying for medicine or housing. So these are literally choices that people are having to make between eating, putting a roof over their head, keeping the lights on.
And one of the survey's most striking findings was that more than 600,000 households using Feeding America programs have at least one member currently serving in the military. That's one quarter of all military households in the U.S. A Pentagon spokesman said in a written statement that the Defense Department's reviewing the results, but he also said that military pay and benefits compare favorably with the private sector, and if a service member has financial troubles, help is available. But Joyce Razor with the National Military Family Association, a nonprofit, says service members are reluctant to seek such help, especially now that the military is downsizing.
People are afraid to call attention to themselves. They don't know who's getting picked to be asked to leave and who's going to get to stay and what the criteria are. And so a lot of these families are just laying low.
And it can also be plain embarrassing to need help. Razor wasn't at all surprised that we were unable to get any military families seeking food aid to go on record for this story.
The reason they go to the food bank is it's anonymous.
But she says she has no doubt that the need is there, even if she thinks Feeding America's numbers might be on the high side. Razor says some families have trouble managing their finances with all the disruptions of military life.
Which may mean at the end of the month, things are a little tighter than they should be.
And free food at the pantry might be just what they need to get by. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
When Jules Rabin lost his job teaching anthropology some 37 years ago, he and his wife Helen turned to baking to keep their family afloat. They began making and selling sourdough bread. People in central Vermont ate it up. But as John Kalish reports, as this summer draws to a close, Rabin bread may also be nearing its last loaf.
At 5 a.m., 90-year-old Jules Rabin stokes the fire in his brick and stone oven. Later in the morning, Rabin uses a burlap coffee sack to mop up ash from the oven floor.
This whole enterprise is based on shmata technology.
Shmata is the Yiddish word for rag. The Rabin's replica of a 19th century peasant oven was built with 70 tons of field stone. Jules Rabin gathered all that stone from local fields with his wife, Helen.
I'm especially proud because after 35, 40 years, it hasn't fallen down.
At 73, Helen Rabin is still able to lift 50-pound sacks of flour and grain in the bakehouse behind the couple's home in Marshfield. Their loaves have only been available in central Vermont. The Rabins refused an order for their white rye and whole wheat sourdough bread from the gourmet food store Zabar's.
You know, the formula for the bread itself and the flour, and the sourdough is really available to anybody, but if our bread is different, and people say it is, and I think it's somewhat different from what most other people make, it has to be the oven.
Helen Rabin has kept her original batch of sourdough starter going since the late 1970s. The Rabins retired in 2002 but started baking again a few years ago when their grandson needed a summer job. Every Friday during the summer, they bake 90 loaves of sourdough bread.
I'm simply the oven man. My work is cruder. It involves some skills. But Helen is the heart of this work. That's all I can say.
The Rabins inspired several wood-fired bakeries in Vermont. Robert Hunt runs Bohemia Bread in Marshfield.
Brick oven bakeries are popping up all over the country. But before the Rabins, nobody really thought of making a living selling bread out of a wood-fired oven in the countryside.
The Rabins' daughter, Nessa, is a pastry chef at a local food co-op. She helps bake and sell bread at the Plainfield Farmers Market on Fridays, where the sourdough loaves go quickly. It's the only place the bread is sold.
The early bird gets the baguette, huh?
Come on, early bird.
The weekly trip to the farmer's market is also a time for socializing with fans and friends, like Eleanor Randall and her husband, Leonard Irving.
This rye bread, oh my God, it's so good. It's just moist and grainy, and the taste is solid. Makes you think you're in France for a little while.
There's no better bread than Jules and Helen's. It's the best. And, of course, baked the same morning. You can't beat that.
That Raben bread will be available for 2 more weeks. The couple says that at their age, they're not sure if they'll bake again next summer. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in Vermont.